Okay, so last week we finished our Vajra's Teshuva, and we're dissatisfied, or at least I was dissatisfied in terms of what he was trying to do. What we're going to do this week is do a series of Teshuvot, some of which were post Ravadia, one of which is roughly contemporary, and hopefully we'll get to learn something about the poskim who we're writing about, and maybe I think the last one, assuming we get to it, which is Rehpenkin, we'll open up some possibilities in terms of understanding what Rav Ovadia was doing himself during that time. Okay, so I start with in Wikipedia gives a list of when prisoner exchanges began after 1976. And I had mistakenly thought that Rav Ovadia was asked about Gilad Shalit because I hadn't realized how many asymmetrical exchanges Israel had engaged in well before that. So you see that right, that after that already in 1978, which is 2 years after Entebbe, there's a I'm sorry, March 14, 1979, one soldier is exchanged for 76 prisoners, 20 of them with blood on their hands, and that was described as Israel's first prisoner exchange in the Arab terrorist organization, and maybe that led to the Lockerbie bombing. Okay, because one of the people released in 1980. In 1983, you get a switch of six soldiers for 4,765 Palestinians and Lebanese
Wow.
imprisoned during the war and 65 prisoners from jails. 1984, you get that Israel swaps 291 Syrian prisoners and 72 others in exchange for six Israeli prisoners. Okay, that's prisoners of war. And then there's what's called the Jabril Agreement in 1985. Where two Israeli soldiers are released for 1,150 prisoners, including 380 sentenced to life imprisonment. So there's a lot, right? So Gilad
Yes.
Shalit, I think it puts Gilad Shalit in perspective in a way that I had not really appreciated. Okay, so the first person I read was Rav Yitzchok Rabag, who was described as the Rosh HaMoatzah Datit, and I can right he writes his tshuva, in 1985, I believe it is. I think I may have made a mistake of moving the date off it, but it was Tavshin Memvav. And I have to say, I read through the Teshuvah, and there was only one source I didn't remember from Rav Ovadia. It could be that Rav Ovadia had it, and that's a Netziv. So just the Rav Chaim Milso, we should look at this Netziv, where the Netziv says, "V'sarach lomar she'ein ze pikuach nefesh mamish," right? Meaning pidyon shvuyim is not. Regular pidyon shvuyim is not because of nefesh mamish, right? The word mamish always means that we don't have a clear distinction. So a new category, pikuach nefesh, which might get to pikuach nefesh. So this is a useful makor pikuach nefesh generally, because why isn't that suffix pikuach
Right.
nefesh? Right, but he has this category, right? And the Gemara and he gives the proof that I tried to bring, right? The Mashmash Enu Ela Tztaka. Because it's in that parameter. Like, what should I do with this money? Right? So it's just Tztaka. Ela Tztaka is Yikara Umuchrachet Hi Mishar Tztakos. It's more important than most other Tztaka, than all other Tztakas maybe even. Avalav Bichlal Bikoch Nefesh. Right? So the Hamech Shela takes that position that regular Pidyon Shvuyim is not Bikoch Nefesh, it's just Tztaka. Right? Rhetorically, we try to have it both ways. Essentially following the Meiri, but I think somewhat starker, and he has the right language of the Gemara. Okay, here is what Rav Rabag says at the end of going through it, basically, although it's interesting to me, he doesn't present it that way, but it's basically just a summary of Rav Ovadia's tshuva, with not so much different at all. He says, "Or kol amor le'el."
The Mo'atzah Datit in Yerushalayim, where does it fall on the spectrum of Sioni, modern, Haredi?
Have to know this is 1985, so it wouldn't have been. I think the lines weren't as like where did Rav Ovadia fall on the line,
That's true.
right? And this is when the Ashkenazi chief rabbi we're going to recall again is Rav Gorin. So I mean, not anymore 1985; it's still 1983. But the lines between Haredim and Dati in terms of Dayanim don't solidify that much at that point. Like there are still, the way we explain it is that Rav Eliashiv was on the high court of the Rabbanut, and it's only it's the fallout from the Langer case that I don't want to talk about in depth today, which happens just before Rav Ovadia becomes chief rabbi in 1973, that causes the radical split we have. Okay, so right, so we just, gives you a list of all the prisoner exchanges before 1985. So you can see that there were many that occurred in the aftermath of Entebbe, whether because of Revadio Tetra or not. And now we're reading
very lopsided.
Very, very, very lopsided.
Very few Israelis exchanged for thousands in cases of hardcore repeat offender terrorists.
Yeah, and no question. There were no. You know, the exchanges were wildly asymmetrical from the very beginning. Right, so one shouldn't think of Gilad Shalit as a change. I think that's the big thing I got perspective wise. Okay, so we're reading Rav Ralbag from 1985. I should have put that the date on. So what he says is, "Leor kol amor leil nir'ed shemikre dinan shel shichur shvuyim sheya karuch b'sagadan lefashot mamash lashiram b'shevi ein kol safek shenaseit nasta mitzvah gedola shel pidyon shvuyim shemutar lifdosam yoser michdei d'mehem." You're allowed to risk lives to save captives because you're allowed to. Because it's a mitzvah pidyon shvuyim, and you're allowed to redeem them when they're in danger of life above their value. Right now he's really strange, right? He says that if you had delayed the exchange even for a minute, you could violate shvichut damim. That's very strong. That's really hilarious. And some people wanted to object. Oil v'shichruram haya barur. I think it should be talui, but I don't know. B'shichrur mechablim sheyesh bem sakana l'tosheva medina. Some people want to object that because the freedom of these captives was connected. This is I think being written about the Jabril agreement in 1985. That's when the Tshuva is written, although it could be one of the earlier ones because we'll see that he gets letters a little earlier. So you could say that the state has no capacity, has no right to put other people in danger. So his language about that is ein bidvarim halalu mamish. These are meaningless words. Vanach lehem l'shiltanot hatzava sheachlita b'davar im yesh sakana im lav. This is a very, very strange argument. He says, well, you're allowed to put people in danger, and anyway, the government gets to tell whether this is a danger or not. Why should it matter? The government decides it's a danger and do it anyway. Right, so he has two arguments that are not coherent with each other. And then right now he says, "Ukimo shachlatal seit la milchama, afal pi shadavar karuch b'sakana." Masina filo milchama rishut. Just like the government can make you go out to war and take risks, so the government can make you do this. So I think that what he's trying to say is as follows: you might think the Gemara said it's absolutely forbidden to take risks because there's a decree you're not allowed to redeem captives. No, it's okay. Now you'll tell me, but this is not a good risk. Right, so that's the government's job. Right. Once we establish,
leave it up to the powers.
Right, but he thinks you have to establish. Right, he thinks that the statement in the Gemara that you don't redeem captives above their value could bind the government. But once we know that it doesn't bind the government because it's not dealing with cases that deal where the prisoners are actually under threat to life, well, then it's up to the government to decide whether it's worth it to take this risk or not. And you can't tell me that the government can't put you under any risk because it's not a prohibition against Yosir Chedei Demayim, and the government is allowed to put people at risk. Right? The government is allowed to decide those dangers, and it goes into the level of war. So that is an interesting way of playing it out. That the job is to make sure that the prohibition could bind the government. Once it doesn't, then nothing binds the government. Except that he thinks that the people who oppose this, right, are in real trouble, because once it's legal and the government decides it's worth it, so if you oppose the government doing it, so now you are a shofech damim. What if you think the government is wrong? The answer is you don't get the truth, right? The government gets to decide what's dangerous or not. So really, opposition to this becomes evil. That's really it's a pretty wild. Right, it's not just mutter; it's necessary, and to oppose it is evil. Once the government has made a security decision, which has this vision of the government as an apolitical body, making decisions that are unrelated to what people want, it's very, 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 very odd. And he tells you, you can't oppose the government because, this is the last line of the second paragraph in his thing. Shemar er et yisodot hanagah tziburit. If you oppose the prisoner exchange, you're opposing the whole idea the government gets to make decisions, and you're causing anarchy.
Meh.
I don't think he gets democracy, though. Like, the short level. I don't think he gets
democracy.
You're
opposing one decision that...
Yeah, and you might think that decision was politicized. And it is obviously part of the government's consideration is what the political reaction will be. Quite astounding. Quite astounding. So here we have a totally different... Rav Avadia is dealing with the question of whether it's permitted. And then, once it's permitted, he thinks it's a mitzvah if you do it. But he never talked about opposition to the government being... he never had to deal with it, of course, because it was in Tevi, and they didn't deal... And it's really strange. The last thing Rav Avadia says is,
okay,
so Rav Avadia said this was halachic, and it was a great mitzvah. That's not, Rav Avadia, this is 8 years after Entebbe, 9 years after Entebbe, and Rav Avadia is consistent. He doesn't say Rav Avadia said the people who oppose it are evil.
Right.
And Shochei Davim, right, and destroying the... Okay. Rav Rabag got a response from Rav Mordechai Eliyahu, who was the Sephardi chief rabbi who succeeded Rav Avadia. This is the bottom paragraph on page one. It's still on page one. Okay, this is actually... Right, the letter is dated Menachem Av Tavshin Mem Hei. So that is 39 years ago. And that's right. So this is 1985. Still possibly before I think it must be right after. It's Menachem Av. So Jabril is written in May 20, 1985. And I think this is probably in August. Right? It's Menachem Av. This is probably August 1985. So Rabbi Rabag's letter was probably originally written immediately after the Jabril exchange. And this is a letter Rabbi Rabag sends his letter to Rav Mordechai Eliyahu. Remember, Rabbi Rabag is not he's not a chief rabbi. He's head of the religious offices in Yerushalayim, which may or may not, I don't know where that puts you on the hierarchy. And Rav Mordechai Eliyahu responds as follows. Shalom b'bracha, kibalti et michtavcha im divrei Torah shekatavta binyan pidyon shvuyim. I received your letter. I received that you wrote, kizakein v'ragil b'ayot hilchotio, which is, one hopes that Rav Rabag is a lot younger than he is. you're right like an experienced guy. like who deals with halachic issues? You wrote well. Yafa katafta v'tovarachta. Had really good editing too. Legabe. Now he has an unreadable word, right? I'm transcribing. I transcribed it from the printed version in a journal, but the printed journal has typos, or Mordechai Eliyahu typos. They didn't print a facsimile of the original letter. They printed their own in their own font. I think this must be Maskanato regarding your conclusion. I don't see it could have been Masechtenu, but I don't know how that relates.
Right.
Yeah, and Masecha, but the word it is doesn't exist. So let's assume you read a really nice tshuva, but about what you said. Imirza Sheva for same tshuva ruka. I'll put out a long tshuva about this. Maybe he did. I haven't found it yet. Ulam l'fotro b'liklum yashar, but I can't not respond. So here's what I'm going to tell you. Kvar yatsa roshu apolim b'shetach ze orech din Shmuel Tamir. Right, the lawyer Shmuel Tamir, who's the head of the people who engage in hostage negotiations, and he organized the dialogue. The siper shiratzal have secret to pull binoseze, she something hatmur binoseze. I blew the next word. So the key line is shatmur lo masach chen beinav. He said this is a bad deal. Umilanu. Who knows more than him? This was not pidyon shvuyim, this was blackmail. Extortion. And he says that Rafael Eitan, who's a Chaver Knesset, who had been Ramat Kal in the past, also says negotiations were done poorly. And many other people say that. Therefore, since, right, Mechar v'atmurah hitashikror, this should be rotzchim, that are not lo... Atide de asu, right? That should be a tough. But they don't intend. They're not. I did a bad job transcribing. I'm sorry. They're not. It's not that there's a risk that they'll come in the future. They're already coming. You're releasing people who are already attacking us. The Gemara says you shouldn't be put in shvuyim yosrim yisay demayim because we're afraid that people will come and attack you in the future. Right? That's our concern. You're releasing people already attacking you. So Rabbi Nachmanides just dismisses out of hand. This has not been enough for him. Okay, so now like the lines have gotten really hard. Right? Rav Avadia said in Entebbe, this is right, it's okay. You can have the negotiations. You don't have to worry that it's Pidyon Shvuyim Yoser Mechlei Demeyim. He didn't give you any lines about what the boundaries were about what is a good deal or not. 9 years later, they're involved in these negotiations. They, right, there is what seems like a wildly asymmetrical agreement, right, where they're releasing two soldiers for 1,150 Palestinians, including 380 sentenced to life imprisonment. And Ralbag still thinks that this is a mitzvah and it's forbidden to oppose the government's decision to do this. And right, it's a violation of Pikuach Nefesh to oppose it. And Rav Mordechai Eliyahu says, what are you talking about? This was a bad deal. Bad deals are not Pidyon Shvuyim. Bad deals are blackmail and usur. No mitzvah at all.
But would he say you could oppose the government if they said, no, we're not going to go through with the deal?
No, maybe right, we would support them, right? Because he was going
to
push them.
He says you have to support the government, yeah. But he says specifically because he's purporting Pidyon Shvuyim here at any cost.
And this so is,
would he also say the flip side if the government said, no, this is
a bad deal? Would Rabbi Ralbag think you could oppose the government? I have no idea if Ralbag is. I don't know what got him so into it. I honestly, you know, it's a wild thing. It's an issue where you see Rabbi is like what? Really, what he's saying is like, who are you? You wrote me a letter. You're a bureaucrat. You know, you've dealt with halachic issues in the past. Right? That's, I mean, it's not nice, but it sounds like what he says is, this is a very pretty essay you have written, and please go away because your conclusion is ridiculous. That seems to be the way that you read the letter. Like, you know, you're treating this as if, you know, your argument that once is mutra, that you just have to, that it has to happen, and then you have to go along with the government and make, and if they went, but they're just wrong. Just totally wrong. But, okay, so now, yes, Dan.
So which part is wrong? The that you can't oppose the government, or that this particular deal is wrong?
Every part of it. I think you're wrong. You're right that it's that it's permitted in theory, but you're right. But you're wrong that this was a mitzvah, and Kal v'chomer to claim. Right, I think he doesn't even mention it, like, you know, because he's there, he's opposing it. Right, so you're claiming there was a mitzvah going on, or you're just totally off. We could have a discussion, like, how far do you go to opposing it?
But right, that argument. So one guy said it was a bad.
He thinks everybody said it was a bad deal. All the experts said it was a bad deal.
And yet they went away. All the who's an expert?
That's a really interesting question. Yeah. Rabbi Eliyahu is essentially accusing the government of making a political decision as opposed to a military decision.
Tell me the difference.
Political decision is what you do because
they want to get reelected.
Because you want to get reelected because you can't deal with it because it's harming you politically not to rescue them.
So
as opposed to a decision that the state security interests require this. Now you could of course claim.
I mean, we could go down a whole rabbit hole.
Yeah, you could of course claim that you are containing an office is the most important thing for the security of the state, right? You could claim, right, that I need to make this decision because I need to stay in office because if the other guys get elected, that will in fact damage the security of the state. That's a very dangerous argument.
Making decisions in order to stay in office because the people you represent want you to decide that way isn't by itself a bad thing. That can be a very good thing. And that's sort of what, in many philosophies, that's what we want of our elected representatives.
Sure, but it's not a decision, right? There's the issue here is, right, if you say a democratic government made a legitimate decision and it doesn't matter why it made the decision, we just accept democracy, that's fine. But neither of them said that. Ralbag said the government, regardless of its democracy, is given the authority to make security decisions. It made a security decision. You're not allowed to question the government's security decisions. And right, that's his argument. And Rabbi Kalio says, no, of course you can question the government's security decisions if they're not making good decisions.
Right.
And therefore, your claim that this is a mitzvah, because after all, it's a mitzvah if the security decision is worth it, it's a mitzvah. No, it's not worth it. Right? So the government, I don't care what the government said, because I care about what the experts say. And government is not experts. Government is a political thing.
But it's not clear that there are any experts in these situations.
Yeah, you could then question Mordechai Eliyahu and say, no, this is the kind of issue at which we should disregard experts and we should only follow democracy. Or if you were a Das Torah dick, think we should only follow halacha, if there's anything halacha has to say about it.
Right. I haven't been to all these, but one of the things, the themes that comes through to my head is that for whatever set of reasons, halacha isn't providing a whole lot of guidance on actual decisions.
Yeah, we don't really want it to provide guidance about what to do in this situation. You want it to provide, tell you whether it's ever, right? If you want to tell you, is it forbidden? You could have a halacha which says you're not allowed to negotiate with terrorists. Mm-hmm. That would be a useful halacha. Right? Once you have a halacha that's permitted to negotiate with terrorists, so then, you know, somebody could have made a policy decision 1,500 years ago or 2,000 years ago as to mm-hmm. exactly what terms you can accept. But that would probably not be a good idea because that's probably, right? That's what Rav Avadia said, I think, in the end. He said, you know, a fairly reasonable thing about halacha is that you're allowed to pay whatever it takes to get captives back, you know, when their lives are in danger, and then use your judgment. Rabag takes that one step further and says, you don't use your judgment. You defer the judgment to the government absolutely, and you can't question it once they make it. And Rav Markaleo says, no. You use your judgment.
Mm-hmm.
And Rabag went to the point, like, and since it's mutter, now it becomes, right, an evil thing to oppose it, if the government, right? And
mm-hmm.
I think Mordechai was highly dismissive, and I don't think he's unjustified.
No, I agree. I'm never going to defend someone who says you can't criticize your government.
Mordechai also goes pretty, right? You're criticizing Mordechai because he's relying on his experts. Obviously, yep. there must be people in the government who, well, the government must have trot out somebody who says this is not a security risk, right? They couldn't get away with it politically. They didn't say that.
So, perfectly fine for him to rely on his own experts. But the issue is it's unclear here whether experts know more than anyone else.
Yeah, also a fair question.
Right, this is not, if we're asking how microbes work, then someone who's a PhD in biology is going to be a much better person
right.
to ask.
This is a rabbit hole because I might tell you that as we learned from COVID that no, actually, ask people how microbes will behave. You're not actually right.
Okay.
Right. Under what circumstances you defer to experts? Right. You know, that way we go back to the best and the brightest. And
I was bringing up that example, I was maybe I should just be quiet.
And the whole question about government, right? This is just a question about the government. You know, to what extent you think expertise is a right, there are many books about this now, right? To what extent expertise is a cult, to what extent expertise is a real thing.
Right, but I think there's something particular in this case because what an expert could tell us in a situation like this is what the outcome of a decision will be. Not whether the decision is fair or good or if I want to pay the price for that outcome.
But what they can tell you, right, this is what the claim is. They can tell you whether the negotiation, whether you got a good deal in the market.
So, okay, so that's fair. They were there at the negotiating table, and they know if, you know, our side was falling asleep and just, or you know, standing strong, whether a better deal
yes.
could have been had through more skilled negotiating.
They can
but that's a very narrow
yeah.
thing.
They can also tell you that they think decisions were made on non-security reasons.
But I I'm going to argue against. I'm going to hold for a moment against this security reason.
You could challenge
thing.
And say you're also political, but it's,
no. Not that it's that it's political, but that what all a security person, an expert security person, theoretically can tell me is what will a near and
that's
perhaps
right.
far-term outcome.
But they can have the dialogue with somebody, and the person says, I don't care what you're saying. We need this to get elected.
I'm sorry, say that again?
They could have had the dialogue with the person who made the decision, in which they said, but won't it lead to this? And the person said, yes, it will lead to this. Isn't that a bad idea? Yes, but I need to get reelected. Somebody could have been honest with them.
So it's a bad... So... The question about whether it's a bad idea is a value question, not an, and that's not an expertise question. I mean, there is a component about how good are you at predicting someone else's behavior,
Right.
right? So we can debate and should debate if you let a convicted Palestinian terrorist out of jail, what will the impact be for that person and for broader political outcomes? Okay, so that can be to a certain degree a question to ask of an expert, but that's different from saying what's the value of that
I agree
outcome?
with it, but I think
And
there's a middle ground where, let's say, I know, right, that I know that you, right, I've always been a supply side, I've always been a demand side economist, right, and all of a sudden you see me making a decision that only makes sense in terms of supply side economics, and I don't believe in supply side economics either, and so I go to you and I say, well, you're not making this decision based on your belief that the economic outcome is good. You're making this decision because you think that that's what will get you reelected. I can know your criteria for decision. I can say by our shared criteria as to what constitutes a good economic decision or a good security decision, it's clear to me that you're not making a decision on those grounds.
But maybe I'm making it on a good value decision because
Yeah.
if I'm an elected official and my constituency says we value this more than we value that,
Yeah. Right. So now we're going to talk about the whole relation to democracy, right? What
right.
is right? Is your, do you trust your constituency in making an informed decision, right? I want to bracket that for now. I just,
Okay,
right, let's
fair
see.
enough.
I think these two tshuva are fascinatingly different than Rav Avadia, but I think that also, to be clear, Rav Avadia was asked the question in purely theoretical terms, right? He's dealing with, he doesn't know what the deal is. He's just being asked, can we enter negotiations? He answers that question. That might be the right question to answer it, whether you think he answered it in the right way. They're dealing post facto with a specific deal, and then that gives you the temptation to judge the deal, as opposed to judge the question of whether you acted properly. And they go to opposite questions, right? So they go to opposite directions where, right, where Rabbi
Just like
judges and says poor, and Rabbi Rabag says you're not right. You can't even think about it. Both of those, I think, are wrong. The answer is something kind of balance, right? If there is some kind of balance, and is in which the value of upholding democratic decision making also plays a role, and the value of government stability plays a role even in non-democracies.
So let me ask you
Yeah.
this. At this point in the discussion,
Yeah.
are these rabbis and our discussion about them, is this at this point, is this a halachic discussion at all?
Absolutely great conversation, right? It's some of them
Because
think
it
it
doesn't
is.
sound like it.
Some of that, right? So I think what you're watch is like either we asked the question when everybody was asked this question, was that a good idea? Would they really care? Or was it just it was a constituency that cared? And right, that's part of the politics, is that, and Ravadia, even again, we might not think the motive argument is right, and we'll see that in a moment. But I think he gives the answer that is appropriate, an answer that is appropriate for the circumstances where the outcome doesn't overstep boundaries and get out of the realm of halacha. The halachic outcome is you are allowed to engage in these negotiations. Right? Both of these, right? And again, because they're tempted because after the fact, move into areas where it might be a bad idea because there's no. So I guess I'll give you a much broader theory. Okay, that's temptation. Now we're not going to finish this week. Okay. We got one more week. It's fine. We really weren't going to. But this is purely me. So you have to be, right? So I'll be warning that, that it's my political theory, which also gets put into halacha. We don't elect as presidents in democracies technocrats on the whole, right? We didn't vote for Michael Dukakis in the end. We vote for people on the basis of some combination of judgment and values and enough knowledge to be able to evaluate what the people tell you. Right? So there's a fundamental question generally, right? Every decision involves value. You have to. Every practical decision means you have to judge the values, you have to judge the facts. The question is, do you want, wait, assuming that the same person isn't going to be the expert on both the values and the facts, or the same group of people. So do you want the fact people to make the decision with the input from the values people? Or do you want the values people to make the decision with the input from the facts people? The decision, right? This is in a sense, this is what I call the Das Torah, the Das Torah argument. Right, as a serious argument as opposed to as nonsense, is not rabbis know more about facts than anyone else. It's that given a decision, given whether, assuming that rabbis represent the values people, we'll look in democracy also. We let the values people make the decision with input from the fact people, as opposed to letting the fact people make the decision with input from the value people. Whereas, right, that's how you make the argument reasonable, for Das Tara. And sometimes it's right, and sometimes it's not right. You have a counter argument, which was where I come from, which is you mostly want autonomy, and therefore, you know, and since rabbis have no reason for expertise about facts, so generally your job is to give the person asking the question the value input so that they can make the decision based on their own determination of the facts.
Mm-hmm.
That's a whole. And you know, and we can talk about how even if in theory you think the values people should make it, and even if in theory you think that rabbis and halakhic scholars are the best value people, which is not necessarily true, that it's corrupting to put them in a decision where they have practical, where they make the practical decisions anyway. So even though in theory it's a good idea, it's corrosive, and we don't want them to make the decisions. And that's what you might see in these shuvot, right? That you end up automatically, you end up invariably confusing your fact determinations for value determinations, and you get that way. So those are all, right? That's, so you know, if you think that fact, that, so the verse side is there's no way to make a halachic decision unless without deciding facts, right? I can't sit as a court judging murder unless I can decide the person is dead. Right? You get up and you tell me they're not dead. Okay, right. I think they did. It wasn't actually a person; it was a positronic robot, right? There's a famous Asimov.
So now we've got maybe two different categories of facts. One is, I'll call them external facts. Is the person dead? Was it Mr. Mustard in the
whatever?
But then there's also halachic or legal facts. Maybe I'm using the word facts.
Death is a fact. A legal
right,
fact.
Right. But just the, someone has knowledge of halacha and what the legal history is of dealing with cases like this. And maybe fact isn't the right word, but it's close. It's a technical.
Yeah, the fact about knowledge. The law, right? And there's epistemological questions like what if the law has consciously chosen a mode of deciding reality, which is not the same as empirical, which is not the same as empiricism, right? Those are also big questions. But I don't think you have to get to that here. I think here it's clear, right, that there's no halachic history for dealing, right, with the evaluation of either of hostage negotiations or of what constitutes the right proper exchange of terrorists by a state. So I think it's...
So wait, here's a question. We're going right off of that, can one imagine a person who is... who is more well-equipped than someone else to make this decision about what sort of trade to, or if any, to do. Who is actually well equipped? Who's better equipped than you?
Right, so those are fair questions. You know, I ask that question on everything.
I was going to say that B, but you know.
I think I tend to prize autonomy, and I tend to diminish, you know, from bitter experience in life, that, you know, that being smarter than people doesn't mean you make better decisions than people. And that part of autonomy is, you know, is that you don't, the best person, I wrote this, I have an article about this in the context of brain death, like whether the goal of halacha is for the person who's best, where the person with the most Torah knowledge should make the most decisions possible. And it's only bureaucratic reasons, they can't answer every question, so we depute, which is one way of reading the conflict between Moshe Rabbeinu and Yisro. Right, that Moshe thinks the ideal is make every decision myself, and so he has to be forced to delegate. And Yisro says, "Who says that's the best? Who says that's the best thing?" Mm-hmm. He tells Moshe, "Look, they'll still bring the big questions to you, you know, right?" Mm-hmm. That's right. That's one model. And the other model is what Moshe says to Yeshua, right? What I really want is for everyone to be Nevi'im, because I want everyone to be able to make their own decisions. And now it might be there's some decisions that they can't make, and then it has to come to me. But the ideal is for the decision to be in everyone's hand. And those are two opposite visions of the way halakha should work. Right? One is ideal is autonomy, but when you can prove to me that halakha expertise or a particular level is necessary to make a decision, I'll impose it on you. And the other is, no, the goal is for the right decision to be made, which is always going to be the best office, and just sometimes you can't reach them. Mm-hmm. Or maybe we don't have a halakhist competent in that area right now, sadly. So since we don't have a great halachos who happens to be competent in the specific area you're asking the question of, so you're going to have to decide what to do with an AI thing yourself until we can train poskim who are expert in AI, and then that will be great, because then all the decisions about AI can be made by Actually, by posthumous great, same, like I just read Oppenheimer, right? So, it's a wild thing that Harry Truman made the decision to drop the nuclear, right? If you were like we're going around the world, we say, who should make the decision about what the long term consequences of dropping an atomic bomb are going to be? Would you have picked Harry Truman?
Well, as it happens, we did.
We did.
He is a mayor.
Great. A whole interesting question. The book of Oppenheimer thinks that was a really bad thing. On the other hand, David McCulloch, right, wrote the biography of Truman, which was the restoring Truman's reputation, in which he thought that Truman was terrific.
Did the Oppenheimer book have a better option? I'm sorry, I'm playing.
Yeah, right. That's the whole question, right? They think that Truman genuinely believed the Russians would not be able to copy.
Mm-hmm.
That was a mistake.
That was okay. Yeah.
Which they think that all the scientists told Truman, mm-hmm. "No, you're crazy. Of course, to be able to copy even without spies."
Mm-hmm.
Now, I have to read McCulloch's book again to see if that's really true, or if Truman, right, because there are so many games about what they knew about what they knew mm-hmm. about what they knew about the spies. Later, right, you get into a Le Carré novel about what anybody. Okay, let's move on to Roger Weiss now, because I want to at least see that one. Then we'll do Rehnken.
Most of the spies were Jewish.
No.
And their handlers.
No. So many. So many.
That's a side issue.
Okay. So now we get to Usher Weiss. Usher Weiss is writing this year.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. And Usher Weiss is a different kind of figure than either Roald Bago. I don't know, honestly. So I can't tell you what Roald Bago is really like.
Mm-hmm.
Or Mordechai Leo. Usher Weiss is an American.
Mm-hmm.
He's been in Israel for a very long time, but he's born in America, and so let's watch what he says. He's the Emes Nira, the Ain Sheila Didon. I mean, he goes what he says first of all. He says is, look, Rav Avadya wrote a shuvah about this, right? So that's also Rav Avadya wrote a shuvah. He's not gonna pretend that he's writing his own de novo material about it. So mm-hmm. But I'm bringing you at the end of this. The Emes Nira, the Ain Sheila Didon Do Meklal Lachol Sugas Gemara. That our question has nothing to do with the Gemaras, the halacha binyan pidyon shvuin yoser mikhtei demayin, and it's not our question today is not the same question as the question in the Gemara, which talks about redeeming captives above their value. The reishit amar, I'll say at the beginning, the imachein banu ledamot inyan didan l'sugyazu. If we're going to deal with our question, right, the contemporary question of whether to engage in negotiations with Hamas,
mm-hmm.
Right, for to that sugya, al korcha nifsok. This is really interesting. He says, you want to say bichdei de mehem, so one person equals one person. So nobody could possibly, his argument is that if we thought this was the right sugya, the answer would be that kidei de mehem would be one person for one person. How could you distinguish between trading 2 for 1 or 1,000 to 1? That's going to be Yosef Michle de Mayim. Umikevench Afichad. Now here's this line. Umikevench Afichad lo yatsia lo yale al dato lesor le shachrer shnei mechablim timurat yudi echad. Nobody would even suggest that we should reduce it to only 1 for 1. Everybody would agree that we would trade 2 terrorists for 1 Jew. Therefore, if you can, once you allow that, that means that you have already decided that the rule about overpaying doesn't apply to this context. So that's a really interesting claim. Is it really true? So the answer is it's empirically false, because Rav Tamir Granot has who is getting a lot of publicity now, unfortunately, because he's the head of an empowerment yeshiva, but also because his son was killed early in the war, mm-hmm. So he's had to become the Dati Lumi voice on these issues. It's very powerful. Mm-hmm. You agree or not agree, it's often and very powerful. He wrote on the draft, right? His response is getting shared everywhere. But so he did say it. But Rav Asher Weiss refuses to believe anybody would say this. That what would happen, right? Rav Granot said it after he said this, presumably. So what happened if somebody showed it to him? I don't know if Rav Asher Weiss would care. He thinks it's not a sensible position to say, right? To say that you can't trade 1 Jew for two, that you can trade them for 1 but not for 2.
Mm-hmm.
Now, I'm not sure he's right about that. I'm also not sure he's right that we couldn't set up, it depends on, that some way, but my moral instinct is all people are equal.
Any reasoning other than stating?
No, he says no one would suggest this.
No, right.
Right. And once you allow one for two, the sky's the limit.
Right, now it's not a lucky question anymore.
Right, but you have to reasonably set a limit.
Yeah.
And how you do that?
I don't know.
Two very dangerous terrorists or 1,000 like nobodies who are in jail. Lots of calculations.
Well, we sell on the slave market, right? So some, right? So it could be that some people are worth more than others, right? So we could. This is very much, you know, I think you get Ravash. This is very much Ravash Weiss, who is a very down to earth, but he is a great London, but he's a very pragmatic, common sense person, which often yields, you know, really fascinating responses. And this is, he has a clear moral sense. And, you know, and this, it just doesn't make any sense to me. How would anybody say you can't trade, that you have a Jew in danger and you can't trade two terrorists? Just doesn't make any sense.
And he's probably by and large right, just in terms of facts, I would guess. If, you know, to get Galid Shalit back, the trade was two prisoners for him, it wouldn't have lasted 5 years, I'm guessing. The pressure would have been the political pressure would have been enormous because people would have wanted to make that deal. I could be wrong, but in that sense, I agree with him.
It's really interesting claim. You know, it's always interesting when somebody says nobody ever said this. Well, we saw this all through Ravanya, right, where people get like, no one ever said that you're allowed to redeem captives. No one ever said they don't redeem captives.
Well, I mean, but part of it is because in these discussions, we keep on dancing around this concept of fair price, and we've been sort of pushing it aside. But I think that is the critical issue, or that is a very critical issue. And it's not at all clear that the fair price is determined by body count.
Sure.
Right?
So he's saying,
which is what he's saying.
Right. And he's going to give him a minute because I do want to get give him a minute because he's going to talk to him.
Okay.
Right. It's Ravash Weiss. I think you can rely on, like, he's very reliably sensible.
Mm-hmm.
Very, very reliably sensible. So he's going to think of these kind of questions.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. So let's watch what he says. He says that he engages, like, he's just really, it's sort of funny. He says, look, the next thing in the Mishnah after you can't redeem cattle over their value is you can't free them. So you're going to tell me that it's usher to launch military missions to save hostages because we are against freeing hostages by force because we think they'll treat the next hostages worse? Right? That's just crazy. So obviously, right, of course, everyone agrees that if the enemy attacks and they and captures things, that's where we are now. We're not talking about captives, you know, at sea, right? Random pirates or highwaymen. We're talking about the enemy attacks your country and captures people. What kind of universe are you talking about? Right, of course you're going to redeem this. Obviously, you don't think this mission applies.
Mm-hmm.
Right? So he just starts off by saying, all of you who are making halachic arguments don't really mean them. Because nobody serious could think that this is a halachic argument. Because everybody, you all agree that you would trade two, right? You would trade two for one when it comes down to it. If you all agree to trade two for one, you don't, right, then you're not dealing with a category of price. And you all agree that you're willing to free these captives at military missions, so you're not dealing with the Mishnah.
Mm-hmm.
So let's just admit that there's no halachic precedent that's relevant. Right? Then he has fun halachically trying to argue. Maybe it's earlier in the Tshuva, right? I didn't have it here. It's earlier in the Tshuva, he went through. He said, look, there are two theories about what price is. One theory is the price is a marketplace price, and the other theory is the slave market price, specifically for this person. But which, you know, he has lots of nice kiddushim in that. But at the end of the day, he says, but everyone agrees, like, that doesn't relate to here. We're not talking about money.
Mm-hmm.
Right? We're not talking about money, then all this is irrelevant. Okay? So he says, no. Right? So he says, A, once it's two for one, B, you can't claim the Mishnah applies. Therefore, he says, but Ode,
Debit Nira, Pasha, Da'af ilo yunim ishachrim rabim elam atim, hayu mechablim misabsim mishtadlin lachtof yudim be'osamida, so here's the interesting thing. He says, you know what? How do you know that the whole risk, according to the Gemara, is that they'll, you know, that you're encouraging them? How do you know that they try harder for 1,000 than for 300? Moreover, maybe their goal is to free all 1,500, And so if you free all 1,500, then they won't come back. But if you free 300 at a time, now they're going to have to capture five more people, right? So they're right. If the logic is right, they want to free this number of prisoners. So if you raise the exchange rate now, they have to capture more people. So maybe it's counterproductive, right? So that argument doesn't work either. Right? He thinks A, it's not a halakhic question because it's not the numbers. B, you don't think the mission applies anyway. C, the pragmatic thing, you don't know, right? How do you know that right? If people have a specific goal they wish to reach, now you can make the same argument about money, right? Maybe they want to make $300 million. So if you pay $1 million per prisoner, they have to capture 300. If you pay $2 million per prisoner, they only have to capture 150. But generally, we assume that people have no limit to their appetite for money. So now maybe we have an unlimited supply of prisoners, that right, of terrorist prisoners that they're going for, but maybe not, right? You know that maybe there's, right, maybe there's a yeah. So he thinks that the whole transaction is silly, and he goes on. He says explicitly, he says what the Chachamim said. They were talking about a completely almetziut acheret b'tachlit. They were dealing with an absolutely different reality. In a time when the whole purpose of kidnapping Jews was to squeeze money. And the whole reason, right? And therefore, so the community wouldn't be impoverished, they said, don't redeem them above their values, on the assumption, he says, that if we could hold our line, they would free the prisoners for the lower price. Because they're engaged, because it's just a market negotiation.
Right, so this is the same debate that goes on with computer, what's the word for the guys who freeze up your computer?
Yeah,
you give them $10.
With French people who have bad viruses. And I read a chuva down today where the people raised fish prices, so now you couldn't have fish for Shabbos.
Mm-hmm.
So the decree was, right, the decree was, okay, community can't buy fish for 2 months.
Mm-hmm.
Until they lower the prices to the point where we'll buy them for Shabbos, right? You have economic power, we have economic power, we balance it against each other. But he says, like, you're out of, right? This has nothing to do with what we're, right? That's the Gemara. The Gemara is dealing with rally. And here they're really going to kill them. It's not the most, right? So on either side, it makes no sense at all. And therefore, right, he says, Softavar, Ein ledamut klal, takanat chazal shetitnu lekilot Yisrael begalut. You cannot bring any comparison between the takanat chazal that they established for communities in the diaspora. But then Pinyan Shvuyim Shnish Bilaman Besakesef, talking about captives who were captured for money. Ladin Shvuyim Milchamat, to captives in war. Shnishbu Bimiskeret Milchamet Yisrael. Shilagabehen Ala Shilton Lishkol Sadim Rabim. Veiladam Abba Zemil to the Milta. Right? That really is a government decision. It's not a government decision because they're right, because we have a clear halachi guideline and the government gets to decide the facts to which we then apply the values or that we declare. Right? It's a government decision because it's a new scenario, which has nothing whatsoever to do with right with what the Gemara talked about. So it's not mutter because we allow you to redeem Kadosh Yisrael Chodei Demayim. It's mutter because there's no basis for saying it's usher. And on the other hand, like, you don't say anything ridiculous like saying it's usher to oppose it. Of course not. Because it's not a pure fact decision. It's always going to be a value decision. And of course you can oppose government value decisions. And so that essentially is Rav Asher Weiss's position, and then he tells you two things. So he says, like, you want rabbis to talk about this. So he tells you there's a story with the Stipler Rav Kanievsky in the biography of him, where the Stipler is really happy to hear about the rescue from Uganda. So it must be the Stipler thought that military missions are okay. And then he tells you the story about Rav Avadia, and he tells you that, you know, the first edition of Rav Avadia tells you that he was sitting with these great rabbis, but he doesn't know who they are. But I have a personally delivered later edition from Rav Avadia, which he does say who he was sitting with. Look at all these great rabbis who sat with him, right? So I have two stories that tell you that military missions are okay, even though right, and Rav Avadia thought that was okay after Entebbe, even though in Entebbe there were Jews killed, right? Soldiers killed.
Mm-hmm.
So his bottom line is Mishum Kol Zenira, the Ein Biyadenu Likvo Halacha Psuka Vura Binyan Zeh, that the bottom line is that we should not establish firm halacha on this ground. Achiyesh Linhog Lefi Ruach HaTorah, but we should engage in the spirit of Torah. Shemitzad Echad Pinyan Shvui Mitzvah Atzuma, right? That there's, on one hand, redeeming captives is a great mitzvah. Umeidach Lishtadel B'chol Oz Lamit Ulmazir Sakanat Yidit. We also have to distinguish, we have to try and diminish future
danger. Right, so this is the recusal tshuva, right? The tshuva that says that really we have nothing. Halacha has nothing to say about this whatsoever. It's purely a governmental political decision, except that we can make value statements. If we think that you are not, that you're callous to the hostages, we can say we don't think you're caring about the hostages enough. And if we think that you're being reckless, we can say we don't, right? We can say you don't think you're caring about that, but we can't say anything more, right? That's just a very, very broad value framework, right? It'll never let you say anything from a halachic perspective about a specific deal. You might say, and I think this, right? I think this, but it would be hubristic. So this is a, you know, he doesn't quote either Rabbi Lorbago or Mordechai Eliyahu. And I think that's you know, I mean, I don't even know if he knows about them, but you know, I don't know how he does his research. You know, he reads lots of interesting things, but not necessarily everything. You know, he reads eclectic things. He tells you in some of it's like, I read this thing. Not so many people read this one, but I read this one. And everyone reads that one. I read that too. Yeah. Okay. He has interesting theories. Like, you know, there's a whole, there was a video that went very viral recently in which he has this thing about the Aruch HaShulchan and the Mishnah Berurah, which is one of the very hot areas. Like, do you prefer the Aruch HaShulchan? Do you prefer the Mishnah Berurah? And he says, like, of course the Aruch HaShulchan is a better lamda. And the Mishnah Berurah wasn't a great posek, but people accept the Mishnah Berurah. So right, the Mishnah Berurah has acceptance, so we do it, right? You know, but don't think it's because he's better. Hey, that would be silly, right? Right, you know, that it's a really, really, again, very, you know, very sensible, pragmatic approach to how halacha develops. So the question is, you know, is this satisfying? So I guess I would say is that sometimes you have to say that.
You have to say,
look, this situation is too radically different than the past. So we have, right? So we have nothing but the vaguest things to say about it. The risk is that the world changes rapidly, and you could very rapidly end up in a situation where halacha never has anything to say, other than like here are the two basic values, right? And we think you should take each of them into consideration. And now, why, you know, that's people ask, like, why do I care what halacha says? It's just doing the same thing that I'm doing, and so people should get up and give very vague value speeches.
So, here's another perspective that maybe would argue that that's not what's going on here. It's not, the issue is not that this situation is different from 2,000 years ago. Rather, that, and it may well be, but that's not the important part. What's hard here is just the nature of this situation where one is forced to do something that halacha deals with all the time, make a decision based on clashing values, right? Where, and that's really
that's what halacha is.
Right. But this is a particularly hard case. And not only will there be clashing values, I don't mean clashing values like good and bad, like I value these two things and I can't have them both. Right? And that's a really hard situation. And not everyone values each of those things the same. And that's understandable. Right? If it's my kid who's being held hostage in Gaza, that's going to change my perspective. Right?
That's all of halacha.
But so I don't have the halakhic answer to what happens if you have a situation that's just particular. I mean, I don't know if it gets much harder than this in life. Maybe it does, but I don't know. And there's no direct halachic discussion of this situation.
There is now. Would that change anything? Because there's now halachic discussion, it makes it better because I have 3-4 tshuvot. There wasn't before they did it. So it's just you can make the second and third decision, but not the first.
So
I'll give a couple interesting ways to play. One is, I think a question that we need to keep during COVID, right? We celebrated the non-Orthodox rabbinate for telling people that they had to follow the advice of the medical establishment. Right? I think that that's a question we should, I think we should celebrate them for having the courage to make that decision. At the same time, it's fair to say, but that was also a value decision to some extent. Right. And and maybe it didn't turn out as well as we thought it did. And so, but should the modern Orthodox rabbinate have said, you know what, everyone make up your own mind, or now about vaccination?
Mm-hmm.
Right? Is that what the answer is? The answer is that the rabbis have nothing to say about whether you should vaccinate your kid for measles. So everyone's balancing their own. That's one model. On West Wing, right, there's the important episode where Bartlett calls, where the Pope calls Bartlett to try and stop an execution.
Mm-hmm.
All right. Now we have all sorts of models of Catholics dealing with conflicts between, right, even sort of from Catholics,
mm-hmm.
Dealing with conflicts between what their decision in their job is, and what their allegedly authoritative religious leader says. Now,
mm-hmm.
It's true that if you have a more sophisticated knowledge of Catholicism, you know that the Pope has no authority over individual Catholics, or anyone unless he speaks ex cathedra, right? That's right. So, and Catholics have had, we have not had enough time, enough discussion in Judaism formally to work out where conscience fits in. Right, Lieberman basically quoted Kennedy when people asked him when he was running for vice president, like what you would do, where you. I follow my rabbi's advice, but about whether I can vote on, whether I can vote on Shabbos or not. Mm-hmm. But I do my own, but I make my own decisions on which things are important enough to do it on Shabbos, right? Mm-hmm. And I'm not going to let anybody tell me whether I should vote for welfare legislation or not. I'll give you this is famous. I'm not telling you anything that's not known. That still in the Clinton administration? Rahm Emanuel is, no, it's the Obama administration, right?
Obama.
Obama's chief of staff, right? And as he's mm-hmm. coming into office, they're trying to pass TARP. And Rahm Emanuel davened in ASBI in Chicago for Yom Kippur. and he asked Asher LePetten, who was the rabbi at the time of ASBI, whether it was permitted for him to make phone calls on Yom Kippur to push people to vote for TARP.
What was TARP again?
TARP was the budget, the whole bailout of the of industries. And Asher LePetten told him that he could use it on an unplugged in cell phone.
On a what?
Use a cell phone not plugged in, so there's no risk of being derisive, but he could use his cell phone, maybe have an aide plug your buttons or things like that. But mm-hmm. that was important, so that was like a fascinating. He asked the question.
If the answer had been no, what would he?
What would he have done if the answer had been? What would he have done if the answer had been? I got asked, third hand, several questions during COVID about what people could do on Shabbos, including mm-hmm. Practical questions. But the question that I talked about was whether somebody who was a government consultant, but whose job was to greatly speed the efficient delivery of necessary medical supplies.
Mm-hmm.
And who genuinely and reasonably believed that the supplies would be delivered less efficiently, less rapidly, and people would die if they were not doing their job, including on Shabbos.
Mm-hmm.
Right. So that's right. And I got asked that as a shayla. Should I refuse to answer?
Why would you refuse to answer?
I could say, look, first of all, I can't tell you exactly what the facts are. I don't know whether you're right. Whether your job is effective or not, or whether this is the right, or whether you're actually engaged in the right policy.
Mm-hmm.
What I tend to say is, I'm going to take the, as long as your position is reasonable, then I think you have a right to your own interpretation of the facts, and I will paskin it based on your presentation of the facts.
Okay.
And then that's throwing me into decisions. I don't know anything about
you know, about, I mean, I, you know, I talked to epidemiologists when this was going on, and right, mm-hmm. it happens that I have, you know, that I have a relative by marriage who was a world mm-hmm. expert epidemiologist. but, you know, but that's not a, I think there's a, you know, this revised position is a breath of fresh air, really, after reading the others, and you can mm-hmm. see like, the others are wrong. I guess I'm sorry, the others are wrong. that's just not right. That's not mm-hmm. a good use of. It's not a good use to Paskin issues. What we know on that way, that we might claim. So Rice is enormously refreshing, mm-hmm. but the way he says it runs the risk that Halacha becomes progressively less. You know, becomes. So I guess I'll say one other thing. This is a thing that made a deep impression on me years ago. So you'll probably hear this from me often if you're in Shir, but I don't think I've said it this year, so it's new. In the Rabbi Walter Wurzberger, Alef HaShalom, some of you may have heard of. Have you heard of Rabbi Wurzberger?
Yes.
He was the editor of Tradition, right? He was a student of the Rav. So he was my professor of ethics as a freshman in college. So he, in his book, The Ethics of Responsibility, which is really important, he said, he put in really his original essay called Covenantal Ethics, the essay that the book came out of. He said there are two basic critiques of halacha. One critique of halacha is that it turns people into automatons. They just follow what the rabbi tells them to do. They follow what the book tells them to do. They don't develop any kind of character. And the second critique is that halacha doesn't tell you whether or not whether or not you're obligated to evade the draft so as not to go to Vietnam. And what use is halacha if it doesn't tell you how to answer the most important questions in life?
Mm-hmm.
And so he said you can't have these two critiques together. Right. If halacha doesn't tell you what to do, that is not right. Vietnam is not turning into an automaton.
Mm-hmm.
Is right, right, right. So his answer was no. The goal of halacha is to train. Right, is to train you to be able to make the Vietnam decision by guiding you through all the other decisions. Right. You should become the kind of person who can make the Vietnam decision for yourself. Right. That had a deep impression on me. As to what halacha is like, a form of ethical training, and I think that's that's like an attempt to balance that, right? There's certain kinds of decisions that are always going to be the kind of decision that you shouldn't be making for other people, right? That's why we have a democracy as opposed to halachocracy, right? And we don't aspire to a situation in which rabbis by fiat make all the practical decisions that have moral consequences.
So that's an issue of autonomy, is the word you used,
and limits.
But
you want to do something, right? You have to be able to make decisions about something,
right? So, but is the conclusion of this example, from this perspective, that there is no correct answer?
I don't know. You've got to wait till next week.
Okay, I can wait. I got a bunch of cleaning to do anyway.
I think it was reasonable for Rav Avadia, I guess I would say, to say that you're supposed to ask the question whether this is okay or not because there might be a law. And then he made the right decision, no, there isn't.
Mm-hmm.
And then it might be after that all you have to decide that the revise is the only thing there is to say, and I can't help you past that. I will only give you some kind of value guidelines.
Mm-hmm.
But maybe you could do a little more. We'll see. I'm glad Harry Truman didn't come to me. That would have been a tough question. I'm not sure I would have gotten it right. But I still don't know what the right answer was.